Hello and welcome back to Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. Six South African male medical doctors on a mission to change the way in which we perceive men's and women's and everyone else's healthcare. Join with me here in the studio is our lovely co-hosts, doctors, Dr. Nhlanhla Vilakazi, Dr. Nasim Sharif, and Dr. Brendan Matthews. I'm Dr. Sir Essa. We're getting straight into it. It's been a lovely holiday. Hope you guys had a good time enjoying yourselves this December. We were enjoying ourselves in the hospital. Anything interesting happened over December?
Just trauma.
It's not even interesting
just trauma.
Anymore. Because it's not interesting anymore. It's alcohol and
trauma. Oh, wait, but hold on. Nasim, okay, he has an interesting story because he was working on the 31st in Hillbrow when they had an alcohol ban at 6 p.m., right? They shut down all the stores.
Yeah. What happened there?
So these alcohol bans, like, guys buy in advance, right? So they're gonna have the stores. The crazy thing is you're going to see it like that night, it was quiet. No patients for a long time.
Wait, tell me what was this ban? What ban was this?
So they just banned all alcohol sales
from a certain
in Hillbrow.
Yeah. In the CBD only.
So the whole of Joburg had an alcohol ban, not allowed to buy alcohol on New Year's
Eve. Not the whole of Joburg, just CBD.
Just the CBD. Mm.
And
just
there was no trauma?
It was quiet, right? Then 12 o'clock, we go outside, we see the fireworks. It was fun, right? We enjoyed. 15 minutes later, trauma just started coming in.
Literally from midnight.
Why? Was the ban lifted?
I don't know what happened. Like, it's supposed to not have been lifted, but yeah. Then, like, it was full of trauma.
But, like, what? The usual stuff.
Yeah, but it was the worst, the crazy cases. I had a guy stabbed in the back, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the midline by the spine, right? In between the scapula. So, stabbed back. You don't think much. Okay, you're going to chest x-ray or whatever, right? So you just see now clinically, this is hemoneumo, right?
Okay, so he's got blood and air in his chest cavity, right?
Mm. You put IC drain. As soon as you open that, cut a blade. Once you go in, right, when you open that thing, blood just comes out, pouring.
Gushing.
Starts gushing, right?
Oh, Lord.
Put IC drain in. That thing just starts coming out of that thing, right, of the pipe.
Filled the bottle,
came out the top.
Yo!
Now we took that the Sanapi bottle, put it up, tried to auto transfuse this guy, right? And it's like pointless because it's already massive pneumo in a hemoclinic. He passed away.
Yeah, he died.
He died, But now, do you not think that he probably had a cardiac injury?
But I mean, from the back though.
Yeah.
So, but could have been also just a aorta as well.
Aorta.
Major vessel.
One of those major vessels.
You guys, when they present to you in this case, you guys would open the chest immediately.
So, like, if they're unstable, like, was he unstable when he came?
Yeah, it was unstable.
Yeah, like in that situation, also, if he's lost more than a liter of blood, then the a liter of blood within the first, I think it's, I can't remember the time frame. But in the first so many hours, you've got to then just crack open his chest and go in and cross clamp the aorta to stop the bleeding.
It's bleeding from.
Do you contact cardiothoracic?
No.
In the ED.
I've done it once before. I'll be honest, I've done one by myself. Well, not by myself, but like with the team.
Yeah.
Literally, the guy, it was someone came in like, this one was a crazy one. We seven gunshots to the chest.
Mm-hmm.
We come in, he's completely unstable.
Yeah.
They put in, they did bilateral ultrasounds, could see that this guy had hemoneumos.
Yeah.
Without even waiting for the x-ray, we just put two drains in. Drains are pouring. We say, okay, we've got to open his chest. We call the consultant, we're like, cool. Consultant says, I'm going to call theater, you crack his chest open now. So we put that, I can't remember what the thing is called.
But you cut it on the side though.
Yeah, so you can cut on the side, or you can cut in the center, cut on the side, basically literally removing the man's ribs.
Yeah.
And then...
What's the point?
When they say cross-clamp the aorta, you basically stopping blood flow to the... You stop the IVC. You're stopping the aorta from supplying blood to the rest of the body. So you're increasing the amount of blood that can potentially... stay within the circuit of going to the lung and perfusing the heart, and perfusing the brain.
If you can find the vessel,
but you basically
that's bleeding,
you clamp the descending aorta. You're not here looking for precision. You can't sit and look. Mm. So we cross clamped and we rushed him to theater.
Yeah.
We got to theater. We find that the bullet had gone through his right atrium. So for those of you at home, you have four chambers of your heart: left atrium, right atrium, left ventricle, right ventricle. It had gone through the right atrium. So when it hits the right atrium, you've got two problems. The anesthetist is battling because he can't get enough blood to the heart, right? Because the right atrium, blood from the body comes towards the heart and then gets pumped. Now, if you've got a leak there, there's not enough blood filling the heart, so there's not enough to give the heart that stretch for it to contract to pump to the rest of the body. So anesthetist is pumping this guy with adrenaline and stuff to keep the BP at least somewhat normal. And then we go in. Literally, they were like, we've got to stop the heart for a few seconds so that you can stitch. And the trauma surgeon is there, the consultant is there, and she's like, you're going to hold the heart.
This is to you.
You're going to hold the heart and you're going to retract. Then I'm going to put the suture through and I'm going to close.
Yeah.
We've got 3 seconds. So basically, the anesthetist is sitting there, stops the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
Bam, gives, I can't remember the name of the drug, but gives the drug, boom, stops the heart. Then you go, close, suture, she ties, done.
Guy's fine.
Now, we managed to save that guy that day, closed him up and everything. It took us like 3 hours to like put the ribs back together and all of that. And then he died in ICU days later. Mm. But that day we saved him.
Do you see how why some doctors think they're God? Because doing things like this,
like when you do it, when I did things like that,
and fixing,
like when you're cracking someone's chest open, and they're like 7 gunshots, he's never making it. Okay.
No, but like I was talking to a friend, and we eventually agreed that you have to be some level of narcissist to become a doctor.
But you have to be an extreme narcissist to be a surgeon.
Especially
you have to have that. You have to believe in yourself.
For you to open someone's chest. Or open someone's abdomen, work in there, and then say, no, he's fine, close. Just close
like
that abdomen.
It takes a different level of self-confidence that you must have.
Exactly.
No, borderline, borderline arrogance. Borderline arrogance. So, I mean...
What is my biggest thing with the alcohol? Like, you can see, you stopped the alcohol. There was an alcohol ban. A long-term ban, obviously, is not feasible, sustainable for many reasons. But one of the biggest things that I saw that came out of COVID was that when there was the alcohol ban and we saw the drastic effects that it had, empty casualties, less trauma was almost zero, car accidents was on the floor, violence, interpersonal violence, GBV was down. Okay, it wasn't really down because other reasons from lockdowns caused it to be up. But we have all of that data that showed what an effect alcohol had and taking it away. But we've done nothing with it. How does your government see that when you remove alcohol, there's this drastic effect and
on
you healthcare. Do nothing about
it? Like if you just look at healthcare alone, on the healthcare system, the amount of strain it puts.
You don't use that data
that
at all.
During that period, people weren't moving as much.
Mm.
So it's very difficult to also use that kind of
Okay, but then NAS, okay, NAS anecdotally, because they did it for NAS.
As a doctor, I know. Most of the cases we see is because of all those problems.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that time, the data that you got during that COVID period.
It could also just be a weird time, but the fact that the government knows so well that they did it on New Year's and it worked again tells you exactly what we need to know. It's not about people being stuck in their home.
Guys,
it's not...
Do something, you know, have the will.
Yeah.
I always say that, like, if I was running a center in a small town and I was in charge of the hospital or clinic, I would ban glass bottles in my town. I would sit with the counselor, sit with the mayor, and say, guys, here's our stats. Let's take away glass bottles and see.
Only plastic.
And you only bring, you know,
that for alcohol. Cans and plastic. I mean, who's going to drink alcohol for plastic?
Brazil will tear the can apart, cut it, and then...
Without alcohol changes, people will drink in anything.
Cardboard box.
Because the most common thing is, Gwenza Galan, bang shayenge portlel. Bang shayenge portlel.
It's the most natural thing to just...
Like every second patient I was seeing... In trauma, as in like eye trauma.
Yeah.
Bottle.
But let me
guess. Like, you know, yeah. bottle. Sometimes you don't even want to ask the history because you can just by looking, you can see this is definitely.
Let me play devil's advocate here quickly. The reason why I know they don't do anything about it, specifically alcohol bans or any of thing of that nature, is because it has an effect on our economy. Our economy, we make a lot of tax money from alcohol sales.
That's true.
Like, and as evil as it is, the government says, well, we need that money, and this is sin tax, so we can raise it every year. But realistically, the prices of cheap alcohol in the location.
Did you guys see how much alcohol was bought over Christmas and Boxing Day?
This was some billions.
1.9 billion or something like
that. Are you serious?
What's that for the year?
Those 2 days. Those 2 days.
Alcohol consumption.
1.9 billion.
More than that. I'm not sure of the correct number. Someone will tell us in the comments the real number. But billion, I'm telling you.
Is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
1.9 billion. But you see, that's why the government doesn't want to cancel.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah. And they don't want to stop
alcohol.
Glass,
the tax on that.
Even the glass tax companies make a lot of money.
And also, look at, I mean, imagine you owned a liquor store, and then on New Year's, suddenly you just get an email, sorry, close shop at 6. Ah, my most busiest day of the year. Telling you it was closed at 6. Come on, that's not fair.
Ish.
But then again, maybe that's the way society needs to move, because then a businessman will say, you know what? Hey, let me not open a liquor store. Yeah. Let me do something else.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're moving on. We have our guest that's joining us here, well, from far away. It's Dr. Margaret Harries from the World Health Organization. And we're going to be discussing many things, including this new metapneumovirus that's coming out of China. So,
is it really coming out of China?
We're about to find out. And now joining us live from Geneva, Switzerland.
Yeah.
It's Dr. Margaret Harries from the World Health Organization.
Very nice to meet you.
Hi, Dr. Margaret.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Harries. We really appreciate your time. So I think to start off with, maybe you can introduce yourself, tell us what you do at the World Health Organization.
Hi, I'm a medical doctor, but I'm a public health specialist, so I haven't been cracking open any chests like you guys lately anyway, not for a very long time. And but I basically speak for the World Health Organization, so I essentially represent our position on everything. But most of my work is in emergencies, particularly emerging viral illnesses, pandemics, all the fun things.
Okay.
Ah, awesome. Okay. So, I mean, on this episode, we wanted to kind of discuss people's fears on this new human metapneumovirus that's coming out of China, which a lot of people are obviously scared about and maybe are misinformed. And we thought, who better than to get someone who's an expert in infectious diseases from the World Health Organization to discuss this. So maybe we can just start with that. You can tell us your thoughts on this new virus, and should people be scared?
Well, I'll answer your last question first. No, they shouldn't. And you mentioned if it's a new virus. It's not. It's been around for generations. It's a family of the Pneumoviridae family, which is not a very interesting name. Same family as respiratory syncytial virus, better known as RSV, which causes a lot of childhood illness. And this one does too. But basically, it causes the common cold. It's one of more than 100 I had to learn as a junior doctor, like rhinovirus and all the others that come around usually at the end of the winter season and spring in temperate countries like yours, and do cause a lot of respiratory illness, mostly coughs and colds. But in people who are vulnerable, it can be worse and become bronchitis or pneumonia. Now, the reason we know about quite a lot of cases in China is they've really stepped up their surveillance. And they're doing something called sentinel surveillance, where various general practices and emergency rooms swab everybody, basically, with a respiratory illness and send it off to a lab for testing. And as you know, I mean, the first thing I was taught as a young doctor was, if you don't take a temperature, you won't find a fever. And it's the same thing. If you swab everybody, you will find a lot of different viruses. And they found that there was quite a lot of metapneumovirus in the population this year. But the stories that have been coming out, like that the hospitals were overwhelmed, are not true. In fact, they've got fewer cases in hospital than they had at the same time last year. They do have a rise in respiratory illness, an expected rise, and we're seeing a rise in respiratory illness in the cold countries, the countries going through the Northern Hemisphere winter right now. We're seeing a lot of influenza, and China actually has much more influenza than they have of this metapneumovirus. I mean, 30% of their cases are seasonal influenza. So essentially, sorry, I'm going on and on and on, but essentially not a new virus, not a scary virus, except if you're vulnerable, if you're a baby, if you're a very old person, if you're on treatment for cancer or something, you don't want to get this, like you don't want to get any other virus. That's why you don't go around kissing babies, especially newborns. Well, you shouldn't. Please don't.
All right. Just a question from me. In terms of the flu vaccine that is commonly given, I think we get a flu vaccine here. Does it cover this type of virus?
Or is there,
are there any vaccines, you know, towards this virus?
No, there aren't. There isn't a vaccine against it, and there isn't a treatment either. Now, you might say, oh, my goodness, then there's reason to worry. But the main reason there isn't a specific antiviral is it because it doesn't cause significant illness in the human population. So the work to develop an antiviral hasn't really been done. Likewise, that's why there isn't a vaccine, because it's not a major threat to the human population.
I did know or read that since the COVID pandemic that we've come out over the past 4 years, that China has actually increased their surveillance on a large number of respiratory viruses, this being one of them. Would you say that it's a good approach for countries, it might be difficult for South Africa, to adopt that and monitor respiratory viruses as intensely? And then taking it away from a national standard, taking it to the individual. If I've got a respiratory illness and, you know, I've got a fever, blocked nose, sore throat, coughing, body pains, would you advise me to go and actually swab and see which virus it is? Because in South Africa, we trained that when someone has flu-like symptoms, you don't test it. There are hundreds or tens and hundreds of viruses that cause these type of upper respiratory or lower respiratory respiratory illnesses. So where are we going, you know, as the world or the World Health Organization? Are we leaning more to testing every time you have a little cough and a blocked nose? Because, where are we going? Is it feasible? Is it what we hope to achieve in future? Could you just advise on that? So a lot of people do come to the ED and then say, Doc, can you please swab me? I want to know what virus it is. And then you explain, it's not really going to change the management.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as you say, it's not going to change the management, because you're simply going to give them symptomatic treatment and they get worse. But it is helpful for us, for the public health people in charge of trying to manage. The balance is not to go and swab absolutely everything. You're quite right. The balance is to have what we call a sentinel survey system. I hope you can hear me. It's saying that my connection's unstable.
It's back.
The balance is to have what China is doing, which is a sentinel survey, and that means you designate a particular emergency department or a general practitioner and say, listen, it's not for clinical reasons, it's not for management, but we'd like you to swab everybody who comes in with a respiratory illness so that we know what particular viruses are currently circulating and we can see if anything's causing a problem. And also, if you then find that, say, it, particularly for influenza, we have something called the Global Influenza Surveillance Network, and we can then see the different viruses, and as a result, we can see what's circulating, how it's changing. And then we have a meeting twice a year to determine what's best to go into the flu vaccine based on what viruses have been out and about and causing trouble. And it's different for, say, the Southern Hemisphere, where South Africa is, to the Northern Hemisphere. So we have a southern hemisphere flu vaccine and we have a northern hemisphere flu vaccine based on that information. So you're quite right. For most people, being swabbed will not change anything and is a waste of their time, your time and money. But from the world global health population, swabbing some people is very valuable and is not a waste of time and money. It's actually very useful. So it's two different issues, really.
And you mentioned that there's no treatment for, viral infections. It's usually just symptomatic management. And so usually we see it in patients who are immunocompromised. So I think the best treatment for it would be prevention. So how would you suggest people to maybe improve their immune system or prevent spread?
Really good question, and exactly right. It's not completely true that we don't have antivirals. We do have for some viruses, but again, you wouldn't even use that on everybody with that particular virus. You would only use it on people who were severely ill or severely at risk. But you're quite right. The best approach is prevention. I mean, even though a lot of respiratory viruses don't cause you a huge amount of suffering, they do make you ill. They do, put you off work. They do mean you can't go to school. They do mess you up. So it is, prevention is much better. And there are plenty of means, so certainly being having a strong, healthy immune system. So doing all the getting lots of sleep, eating a good, healthy diet, not smoking, not having lots of alcohol, all those things will put you in good stead for warding off, fighting off the virus. But the other things also, ventilating your home, ventilating your workspaces, making sure that you're not in a situation where you're in a really overcrowded space. And this often is difficult for an individual. This is down to governments and those who organize our workspaces to be a little bit more thoughtful about helping us all not end up having the coughs and colds every winter, because we're being herded into spaces where the ventilation is very poor. And lastly, of course, masking up when you can't avoid it does really help. We have seen a lot of work now that suggests that indicates that if you're forced to be in a space where you're not able to avoid being exposed to other people's viruses and whatever they're carrying, wearing an effective mask does work.
Thank you so much, Dr. Harries. Just maybe lastly, before you leave, I'm quite interested to find out maybe what kind of projects you are part of at the WHO, what you guys are planning to do in the next couple of years, what you guys are focusing on from a public health perspective.
That's a very good idea. Thank you. That's a really great question. We're doing a lot. I think one of the really important things for the world is the pandemic treaty. That is being negotiated, being led by the member states, and it's come out of all the lessons that we learned, things that we got right, the things that we got wrong, particularly the things we got wrong during the COVID pandemic. And one of the things we really got wrong was not finding a mechanism that ensured that the tools that worked, the vaccines, the antivirals, the diagnostics were shared fairly. They were only made available to, they were more available in the countries that developed them, and they kept more of them than they needed, and they didn't share them to the groups that needed them most, particularly the vaccination, which was the thing that really got us out of the COVID-19 pandemic. So it meant some countries were struggling for longer than they should have been. This pandemic treaty, we hoped to have it all signed and agreed by last May at our World Health Assembly. It's still under negotiation. We're hoping we'll finally have it by next May, and that's absolutely critical. Something else that's been really important has been changing international health regulations. We found that with the COVID-19 pandemic, people didn't understand the seriousness of it until it became a pandemic. But we actually declared it as a public health emergency at the end of January 2020. But but nobody really paid attention to it until March 2020, when it had reached such a severe status that we declared it as a pandemic. The reason we declared a public health emergency 2 months earlier was to stop it from being a pandemic. But unfortunately, the world didn't take it seriously until we used that P word, pandemic. So we've changed how we explain an emergency, how we raise the alarm, hoping that the next time the world will take it a lot more seriously, a lot earlier.
Thank you so much, Dr. Harris, for joining us. We really appreciate your time and your input in this discussion. Really enjoyed hearing your insights on this new virus and the World Health Organization. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Harris. You put a lot of South Africans at ease.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of South Africans that are very worried about a virus in China.
We know what happened last time.
When we hear virus in China, we all get scared now. So I think
you're not alone. But I promise you, you've all probably had this one already.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice to be with you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Cheers. Bye.
So interesting. Thankfully, we don't have anything to worry about. We can all tell our patients to relax. Calm down.
Yeah, calm down.
That Chinese virus is speaking its own language. So they come here, not no Tswana. Right? Yeah.
One thing people need. Oh, sorry.
Sorry. One thing I wanted us to have explored, even though, I mean, we obviously ran out of time. I wonder what the World Health Organization has to say about the mechanism of surveillance that they use during the COVID pandemic. Like, was there a stage where they felt like, you know, it was just too much? Like,
too much. Swabbing everyone.
Swabbing too much. Like, I mean, showing daily stats of people being infected.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, didn't that, you know, I'm sure that caused a lot of anxiety and fear.
I mean, look now, like, even if you think about it now, this virus comes out, people don't even think twice. They're already like, we're all going to die, lock the country. Because we've got into such a state of panic. Like, I get it, at some point, you need to be informed. But at what point do you as a government or you as an organization go, but not all of them need to know this much information?
Yes. Yeah.
The fact that it's so accessible for everyone, now that the layman in the street, he's just getting anxious and worried looking at this. He doesn't understand it.
What is
100,000 cases? what is it? You just hear 100,000, but there's a billion people
in the country.
Like, then it doesn't make, you know, to him, he goes, 100,000, oh my God, we all die.
We're all going to die.
Because I'm sure we all know people who've, when you tell them it's COVID, they just like, they die. Or it's just like, it's over. I've got COVID. Yeah. It's going to
dig his grave now.
You know? So that is really important one. I just wanted people and South Africans to know that flu does kill.
Right? Yeah.
Flu kills. And when we say flu, we're talking about influenza.
Proper, because
we're talking about
the layman in the street thinks flu is just a cough, a cold.
No.
Influenza.
Influenza.
Specifically influenza group of viruses. Those can cause major respiratory problems.
But in immune compromised people.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that's the main point. Like, try to tell people, like, guys, get your immune system sorted.
Mm.
Get vitamin D. Like, get sun exposure. Have good sleep. Zinc, exercise, those kind of things.
Yeah.
So
we
take TRT if you need.
for the flu vaccine in particular, look, like I said, there's hundreds of viruses that can kill you if your immune system is weak. But our guidelines in South Africa say pregnant women, elderly, and the elderly should be first in line for a flu vaccine every year between March and May. Right.
Mm.
And then healthcare workers thereafter. So we should also be getting it.
Wait, you advocate for flu vaccine?
Yes, I do.
I don't.
Have you tried it? I
haven't.
Yeah. So you don't know.
You never had a flu vaccine.
But I don't get sick in this one year. In this whole year.
Because you're taking lion's mane and
immune system is on point. You just don't get sick. Why do you need flu vaccine if you don't get sick?
Yeah, true.
I think the only reason why I haven't been catching any of these viruses is the use of a mask. I'm way more like, I can't.
Yeah, I mean,
can't
by that logic, Nassim, you should never wear a condom because you've never caught it.
No, but he's not wrong. He's not wrong. But for elderly and pregnant women, for example, they need it. They can take as much sea moss as they want.
These guys just don't wear a condom because they got strong immune system.
Does that make any sense?
No, I'm saying, like, no condom.
There's people watching here who are going to cling on to what
you're like, saying. Yeah, I'm going to take.
I'm saying that's his logic.
That my immune system is strong. I'm strong.
No, I'm saying I that's a protective the layer. Yeah, that one. The vaccine is just a protective layer.
That one. I shoot through the HIV. I'm telling you.
Anyway, let's wrap up. We have to wrap up this episode. We have one last thing to talk about this year. You know, unemployment in doctors is high. I don't know why people get like, why do people get worried? Like as if this is a new thing. Every year they come out, where are our jobs?
Yeah.
Keda,
the job crisis is there.
If you were there, you'd be crying as well.
I suffered.
You know what's a big problem? We all know that our hospitals are understaffed.
Yeah.
We all know all our departments are understaffed. 100%. There's no doctors. Patients are queuing endless hours in casualties. And then to find out that, you know, there aren't any posts and the government is not willing to hire.
In Cape Town, it's actually...
And then you hear things like 16 billion was returned to Treasury because, yes, the government didn't have any expenditures. You understand? I mean, those things are very frustrating. So I see where people come from. And
100%.
And I think if people want protesting about these things, I mean, things are just going to get worse and worse and worse. Yes, private will accept them.
Yeah.
But I mean...
No, but also must explain why doctors are so frustrated. Like, some of these guys are bursary holders, right? So they have a contract to say that they have to work at that place. Otherwise, they can't work. So then they have to be employed. So if you're not employed, you hold them ransom, right?
Mm.
Even like the fact that you have to if you want to specialize, you have to go into the public system.
Yes,
you can't just go to private and specialize in it, right?
Mm.
So those aspects make you force you to work into government, right?
Yeah.
If it was other avenues, no one would complain.
Mm.
Everyone would gladly go to private.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because you can still specialize through there, but now you need government.
In Cape Town, I know of cases, because I have some friends that are working in Cape Town. The job crisis is so hectic. So a friend of mine, he's got the primary exam for anesthesia. And this exam is basically your entrance exam to get into a specialty. It's one of the prerequisites. Obviously, experience and diplomas and other training counts towards it. He's had this diploma, the primary exam for over a year. He hasn't even gotten an interview. He's told me that there are other guys with experience, with all of their exams and everything, that are literally taking supernumerary posts, meaning they are working for free to specialize.
Yeah.
So for 4 years, no income, working as a doctor, nights, long days, I cannot imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
And look at how unethical that system is, because if you have the backing, if you've got rich parents who can take care of you for 4 years, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going to school.
Yeah.
You wake up in the morning, you go to school, you finish your day, and you can carry on. So if you've got those rich parents who can do that and are happy to pay for you for 4 years, then good, go for it. But for those of us who don't have the financial means to just sit back and say, I don't need an income for 4 years, so the payoff at the end will be worth it because I'll be able to make...
And that's actually not even guaranteed. I mean, we have NHI coming up, so fees might be standardized. So you're not even guaranteed to say when you finish and when you become a consultant.
I think NHI is coming because this whole system is going to collapse if it doesn't come.
Mm.
It can. It'll be doctors. I saw someone writing on Facebook that they, or somewhere, I qualified in 2016. Since my Comserv finished in 2019. I sell eggs and stuff at the taxi rank.
Promise you. That's a lie.
I thought, but you're not serious.
You'll get a locum, please.
Since 2019, you're selling at taxi rank. But what do you guys think about the claim that some people make that government releases posts in rural and no one goes? Huh?
That's true. Let's not even lie.
Right now, I've seen...
Will you go? Yes,
that's true.
That's true.
Would you go to
rural?
If you're unemployed, yes.
And
I think only foreigners would
only foreigners
are you allowed to protest now if government is saying I'm throwing you Northern KZN, there's a job there, go there.
Look, I was willing to at a point.
They're putting you in Chokabi district in,
and that was I have a job Eastern but K. I was willing to go to Northern KZN to work in Richards Bay and Ngwelezane because it was in the position that I wanted to be in. It was,
and that's a stepping even like stone. Suburb, it's not really rural.
No, that's in Imbangeni. It's
even
rural.
even still, right, Cyril? Even if it was super rural, if it's in that post that you wanted to specialize, you would do it.
Yes.
Yeah, but I suppose for some they just wouldn't. I don't think it's that like broad of a problem where everyone's saying no. I think for some people they look at it as, can I get a step? Is this going to help me progress in my career if I go there?
Yes.
Not just I'm going to the Bundus to do nothing. Just to get money, because then there's no career progression. And then what's the point?
Yeah.
But anyway, look, we can go on and on talking about this. We've run out of time for today's episode. We're going to come back and we're going to actually bring a guest into studio who's championed this cause, and we're going to talk about unemployment in doctors. Thank you guys for joining us for another episode of Let's Talk Man with the Gents Clinic. My name is Dr. Soyalesa, signing off.
Dr. Ntlanthe Vilakazi.
Dr. Naseem Sharif.
Dr. Brendan Matthews.
We'll see you guys next week.